mind actually turning it upside, I suppose. Okay, great. Thank you. Okay. Good. So, well, I'm glad some of you have braved the weather. That shows your dedication to Durkheim. Yes. So, as you know, it's 3 p.m. tomorrow, but really be sure to do it by 3 p.m. because the office show closes at 4:15, and then you will be in deep trouble. Okay? So, 3 p.m. tomorrow in TSI boxes. Any questions about that? No, okay. Right, so what I want to do today is finish Durkheim. And you can see, well, we'll be going over material that we did last time and in the review session to some extent. And then I want to compare Durkheim with Marx, Lenin, and Gramsci. And then we'll have the pleasure of ransacking Durkheim. So we'll be ransacking Durkheim for the rest of our lives. Good. Now, Thursday, we will begin Michel Foucault. Light entertainment. I want you to read the... Michel Foucault spent an inordinate amount of time here at Berkeley, and there is a very nice little article in the Reader from the Daily Cal about Michel Foucault, an interview with him, which I think you should all read. And then... you should read pages 3 to 9, but only do it under, take a big glass of whiskey or something, as you read pages 3 to 9. It is quite grueling. That'll be a change from Durkheim. Yes. So, and when you read pages 3 to 9, think of mechanical solidarity and organic solidarity. He's a Frenchman. They all think the same, these Frenchmen. They just have different vocabulary. Ha ha. We'll see. Okay. Any questions? It's in DMP means discipline and punish. That's a book you should have. And the Reader is available. Okay. Any questions? They did? Well, they make them overnight if you order them, or they ran out of copies. Okay. Any questions? Going, gone. All right, very good. So, yes. So, well, we have been building up to book three, and, you know, this book three really sort of, to my mind, represents the truth of Durkheim. But you can't read book three without book one and two. And... so, but the central point is that book one is really laying out the idea that as a division of labor develops, so restrictive law develops, and so we get a movement from mechanical solidarity to organic solidarity. Book two is the first analysis of transition, the transition, broadly speaking, from mechanical solidarity to organic solidarity. And essentially, it's a story about increasing density leading to struggle, leading to one solution is a division of labor, the one that Durkheim is particularly concerned with. But book three turns to reality. Book two, I mean, the history is a bit of a story, you know, like all those origin stories, the origin division of labor, the origin story, you know, it stretches the imagination, it's very abstract, it's not very very, very historical in a sense, it's like Adam Smith's story of hunters and gatherers and so, but book three really brings us down to earth, brings us to reality. Durkheim faces all around him conflict, yet he claims what? The division of labor is going to lead to solidarity. Well, so what's he going to do? Well, he says, well, division of labor normally leads to solidarity, but abnormally leads to conflict. So basically, if there's conflict all around, it is because the division of labor assumes exceptional, pathological, or what we might call abnormal forms. That is why we have conflict. Once the division of labor assumes the normal form, then we'll have solidarity. So the big question is, what must happen for that abnormal division of labor to become a normal one? What makes the abnormal division of labor exceptional? And he has, yes, you remember it, three forms of abnormal division of labor. Anomic division of labor. Well, that is a division of labor in which society is in turmoil, in transition, and as a result there is a state of normlessness, disorganization, and conflict. And he talks about economic crises, moments of deep class struggle. These are moments that are transitory, will disappear, and give rise ultimately to the true division of labor. So from the standpoint of the anomic division of labor, that is a state of normlessness, it's a matter of just of letting the division of labor be itself. But let us get over the transition and we will enter the realm of solidarity, the true normal division of labor. If and only if, and here we come to the second abnormal form, the forced division of labor. Now, this is, to my mind, the most interesting of the three abnormal forms. So we have the anomic division of labor. Let's put it up here. Abnormal division labor. We have the anomic form. And the response to the anomic, that's the idea of transition, transformation, turmoil leading to conflict. Second, we have the forced division of labor. The forced division of labor. This has two forms. The first form of the forced division of labor is the idea of individuals, in a sense, being forced into places, into occupations for which they are not fitted. The relation of individuals to occupations. And what does Durkheim say? He says essentially that individuals must occupy places in the division of labor for which they are suited and talented. And for that to happen, there must be what? Equality of opportunity. Equality of opportunity. People must have the opportunity to find their true place in the division of labor. For that to happen, for there to be true equality of opportunity, he says we have to do all sorts of things. He talks about the elimination of the inheritance of wealth. Because if one has wealth, economic wealth, then that gives undue advantage to certain people who can buy places in the division of labor for which they are not suited. So we have to eliminate the inheritance of wealth. We've got to, as best we can, eliminate inequalities of birth due to being born into different families. Well, that's how I interpret page 314 anyhow. And we have to have things like affirmative action that really gives advantage to those who are disadvantaged. That is radical stuff. That's radical stuff. He takes, I think, very seriously the idea of equality of opportunity and comes to quite radical conclusions about what must take place if we're going to have this mapping of individuals with their talents mapping into places for which they are equipped. So that's the one idea. And the second idea is the relation of function to function. Function to function. That is to say, and he usually uses the relationship between capital and labor as his illustration here, and he essentially argues that there has to be an equality of power between different groups in society if the relationship of interdependence is to lead to solidarity. So there's got to be some interdependence, reciprocal interdependence between management and workers, capital and labor. That is to say, capital has to depend upon labor as well as labor upon capital. That is to say that if workers are terrified of losing their jobs And if they lose their jobs, they no longer have access to means of subsistence. That is a very unequal relationship and will not lead to solidarity. So essentially, Durkheim is suggesting that we have to somehow support labor once it loses jobs through things like welfare and unemployment benefits. We have to support labor so that, in fact, capital becomes dependent upon labor as well as labor upon capital. There is a sort of mutuality in that interdependence. That also is quite a radical project, trying to equalize the power relationships between functions. So, we might say, okay, that's... So that's the set, that's the force division of labor, the two dimensions. And the third one, which we didn't talk about in class, is the, what I call, Durkheim calls the third division of labor, I call a discontinuous anomic form, discontinuous division of labor. And there he's talking about what the malcoordination among the parts. They're badly coordinated. So he says on page 324, since we didn't read it last time, 324, let me read it to you. Get your books out. Time to get your books out. Okay, well, it's all over this chapter. You can read on page 323 where it begins, but let's read 324, the new paragraph on 324. Who would like to read this out? Conrad, where are you? There you are. Conrad, you're on 324?
Yes.
Paragraph, new paragraph, on the contrary.
On the contrary, it matters a great deal.
Who knows what? Let's go on. Yes. This is because
solidarity in general depends very closely upon the functional activity of the specialized parts.
The functional activity of the specialized parts, their contribution to the whole. Go on.
These two terms vary with each other. Where functions are faltering and vain, may they be specialized. They are badly coordinated with one another and are incompletely aware of their mutual dependence.
Right. Very good. Very good. So there is the idea of malcoordination. The parts of society are badly coordinated with one another. And there is not a sense of the mutual interdependence of the parts. So he says on 326. All right. It's an interesting paragraph. The first new paragraph at the top of the page. He says four lines into it. Well, let me read the whole paragraph. Consequently, they will be more solidly linked to one another, indeed, be more continuous in their relationships. That is, he wants to have parts linked to one another, more continuous in their relationships, are more sequential and more continuously in need of one another. Ah, thank you very much. It's okay, but actually I don't need it. Very good. Okay. They are therefore more aware of their dependence upon one another. Here we go. Under the regime of large-scale industry, the entrepreneur, the manager, capital, is more dependent upon his workers, provided they know how to take concerted action. For by stopping production, strikes prevent capital from earning its keep. But the worker also can less easily be idle because his needs have increased with his work. When on the contrary, activity is less, needs are more intermittent. And this is true for the relationships that link function together. They feel their solidarity only sporadically, and for this reason it grows slacker. What is he saying here? What is he saying here in this paragraph? Under the regime of large-scale industry, the entrepreneur is more dependent upon his workers, providing they know how to take concerted action, for by stopping production, strikes prevent capital from earning its keep. What is he saying? Matthew?
That strikes hurt everybody.
That strikes hurt everybody. Well, it says here, strikes prevent capital from earning its keep. So, under the regime of large scale... Anybody else want to interpret this paragraph? Oh, shoot. Are you Monica? No, you're not. You are? Yeah. Very good. Thank you. Yes? Yes, very good, very good, very good, very good. BBB. Yes. The idea here is not quite what you were saying, Matthew. The idea here is that by striking, workers remind capital of what? By striking, workers remind capital of what? Kristen? Of how dependent capital is upon labor. See, that's what is being suggested here. He says, under the regime of large-scale industry, the entrepreneur is more dependent upon his workers, provided they know how to take concerted action. For by taking concerted action, they prevent capital from earning its keep, and reminding capital that capital is dependent upon workers. If everybody strikes, then everybody knows. If workers strike, then capital knows that they depend upon it. Look, if the garbage collectors at this university struck, we would know about it within a week. This would be a dysfunctional, completely dysfunctional. But it's only by striking that we are reminded of our dependence upon garbage collectors. So this is what he's encouraging here. He's encouraging what? He's encouraging workers to strike from time to time, to remind capital. You like this, Felipe, yeah? To remind capital of their dependence upon workers. They must be able to take concerted action. To remind capital of their dependence upon workers. Workers, of course, know that they're dependent upon capital, but capital doesn't sometimes forget that it is dependent upon workers too. Okay, so that's a way of encouraging. So strikes, in a sense, will build that interdependence and that solidarity. Yes, the whole point of this chapter on the discontinuous division of labor is that it's not just a matter of the coordinating of parts, but is also of the recognition of each side's dependence on the other, the subjective recognition of each side's dependence on the other, and therefore the feeling of unity with other. So he says on 328, the last paragraph, he says, who's here? I can't see everybody. Sienna's not here. Sienna. Claudette, why don't you read for us the last paragraph on page 328?
We are thus led to acknowledge another reason that makes the division of labor functional.
Don't dribble off into nowhere. I want to hear you.
Not only does it cause individuals to be self-related to one another, as we have maintained up to now, because it limits the activity of each one, but also because it increases that activity.
Right, so very good. So the idea is a very simple one, that solidarity is produced by the intensity and continuity of activity. The solidarity between you and me is intensified, is increased by the intensity, yes, Sam, of the interaction between... between... Yes, no, between you and me and between yourselves. It's the intensity. You know, if I came in here and you're always falling asleep the whole time and walking in and out, that would be a state of malcoordination and there would be no solidarity between us. But because you're so disciplined and so intensively engaged in understanding Durkheim and in listening to me and being feeling dependent upon me and I upon you, that intensity of that relationship builds solidarity between us. Yes, Sam?
Yes.
Very good. Yes, Jane? Sorry? Ah. Well, what's the difference? This is about what? This is about mutual independence and what is necessary here? What makes it forced? What makes it forced? Inequality of power between the... So it's an inequality of power between you and me. That will lead to... But here he's talking about something different. He's talking about the disorganization. The fact that you might be just wandering in and out, falling asleep, looking at your Facebook, all the sorts of things you wouldn't dream of doing. Yeah, so that's, basically it's a matter of, this is a matter of power, this is a matter of coordination. Slightly different. He's making a slightly different point. In the beginning of this chapter, he talks about the importance of leadership as a way of coordinating, ensuring the coordination among parts. Yes, Jason?
I'm confused as if all of these, maybe mentioned, they run fluid, or if there are stages of...
What do you think Durkheim is saying?
I think they happen kind of simultaneously.
Yeah. I think so. I think, you know, they are different, but there's no reason why they should not be happening simultaneously. And there's no argument, I believe, no argument here about them happening sequentially. There's nothing, I believe, in this text that suggests that. And I think naturally they can, in fact, occur simultaneously. There's no reason why they shouldn't. And I think that's how he conceives of it. Yes, Matthew?
The impression I get from reading the, this chapter is that...
Which chapter?
Oh, I'm sorry. The one with the discontinuous chapter?
Yeah. This is the weird thing about Durkheim. These are all abnormal because they're exceptional. They're all exceptional. But in fact, they're contemporary.
But is he... I guess in the other chapters, I feel like he describes it empirically. In this one, I don't feel like...
Yes, well, I think, well, he doesn't give many examples in this chapter. It's mainly, again, the capital-labor malcoordination. But he's, I think this is, to answer the same question as my sponsor, Jason, that their status is similar. I think that he does see malcoordination happening all the time. And in fact, the discontinuous is often very linked to the anomic rather than the forced, by the way, Jason. Was it you that asked that question? No, somebody did. No, it was Jane, right? That's right. That the discontinuous is often more linked to this one, because this one, there is everything is changing, and therefore, in a sense, there is a malcoordination. But I think they're all, quote, exceptional, because for Durkheim, exceptional means abnormal, and they will all give rise to the normal division of labor. So I don't think this is any different from the others. I don't think there's any sign in this chapter that he thinks it's less frequent than the others. Yeah. Yeah, very good. So there you are. I mean, one example would be, for example, the relationship between family and the division of labor. You know, we talked before about family leaving California. Family leaving California is a way of actually, what is family leave? It's none other than the payment to families for what? For looking at, for having children, for looking after children, for looking after elderly parents, for looking after sick parents, siblings, whatever. It's all contained. But family, basically, it's the way in which the family can continue to function at the same time as it can be part of and feed labor into the division of labor, into the labor market. And it was one of the interesting things about the plurality of the different forms of family that we see in the world today over the last 15 years. There's been a pluralization. We no longer have, you know, the single male breadwinner, if we ever did, but much less so though, over the last 50, 60 years, the single male breadwinner, the woman, wife stays at home looking after the children. That was perhaps the norm for a substantial proportion of the population. Today we have a plurality of different types of family. Why? Because they are in different relationships to the labor market. There is a sense in which the family and labor market are becoming much more coordinated, connected to one another. And so what was discontinuous before is now become much more coordinated. Yes, Simeon.
So the force division of labor calls for a concrete, like, political program.
Yeah.
And the discontinuous then calls for what, good leadership?
That's what he seems to imply. I think even on the opening page, he talks about leadership, planning, coordination. It's not clear, not as clear a political program at all. It's more like a technical thing rather than a political project. Yes, you're absolutely right. So a gnomic calls for nothing. Let's just get over the transition. The force is a real political project, it turns out, in its two dimensions, and discontinuous is a more technical matter. Yeah. Okay, very good. Any questions on all this? Yes.
I thought you say that all three are causing the transition happening too fast.
Well, Durkheim is suggesting the transition happens fast, and that leads to the anomic division of labor. I don't think that there's any necessary link between transition. You can have a forced division of labor, you know, in a sense, even if the world is relatively stable. Because it's to do with whether individuals are... It might be one of the reasons why you may have a forced division of labor is because of transition. But it's not... I don't think there's any argument in Durkheim that says it's because only because of change that you have the forced division of labor. He defines that precisely as this inequality of power, inequality of opportunity. You might say that they are all in a transition because in the end... Well, in the end, we're going to get what picture? We're going to get what picture? Let's go over here. See, in the end, we're going to have what? Let's put it like this. In the end, here's the abnormal. And we're going to have anomic, forced, discontinuous divisions of labor. Discontinuous division of labor leading to these are the abnormal forms leading to what Durkheim calls a spontaneous division of labor. Which is going to be what? The normal division of labor. This leads to what? This leads to disorganization and conflict. And this leads to what? Solidarity. Now, I think it's an interesting question whether, in fact, this can be seen all as part of a transition, the forced division of labor, too. Where, yeah. The forced division of labor is explaining conflict and disorganization not as a result of change per se, but these inequalities of power. So it's a different explanation, though it may occur only if may occur in the context of change, but the real source of the conflict is the inequalities of power and the inequalities of opportunity. Right? Look, let's draw a bit better picture. Remember, what were these? These were the natural abilities. Natural abilities. And these are the social positions. And the idea is that they should be mapped onto one another. That those with a certain natural ability should find the equivalent social position. But there's all this stuff called external inequalities. External inequalities. And what are those external inequalities? Well, there is inheritance of wealth. Well, basically it reduces to inequality of opportunity. Inequality of opportunity. Opportunity. And inequality of power. And then eventually the inequality of opportunity becomes equality of opportunity, inequality now becomes equality of power, and then you have hunky-dory, this situation. natural social positions, and they're in correspondence with one another. That's the story. Here we have these external conditions of inequality, external inequalities that make it impossible to have this nice mapping. Those inequalities disappear and we get the coordination of the natural abilities and social functions and the equalization of power among functions. Yes. Who are you?
Andy.
Uh huh.
So does the state have no role in correcting for the gnomic division of labor? Because I thought I understood that the state would create conditions for functional division of labor by regulating human functions.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
No more than that, though.
Yeah. That. It's always incredibly ambiguous how Durkheim sees the state. Well, on the one hand, of course, we know in the context of mechanical solidarity, it's an expression of the collective consciousness. In the context of organic solidarity, Durkheim says that you need more and more state to regulate the relations among the parts, to ensure that there is reciprocal relationship of independence between capital and labor. We have labor law. We have relations. We have family law that sort of tries to equilibrate the relation between husband and wife and parents and children. Regulating relations. And he says that as organic solidarity or as division of labor develops, there has to be more and more state regulation. But that's on the one side. But on the other side, the question is, does the state actually eliminate these inequalities? That's the big question. Certainly, once they're eliminated, it ensures that there is a continued reproduction of equality. But what is that's the big question. How to explain this transition? And I think in explaining this transition, the disappearance of these inequalities, it's not clear what role the state has to play. That's what we're going to examine in a minute. So the state is necessary. It becomes bigger and bigger with division, as the division of labor develops and with organic solidarity, contra Spencer. But it's not clear what role the state plays in actually getting rid of these inequalities. What role the state plays, for example, in eliminating the inheritance of wealth. It enforces it once inheritance of wealth is eliminated, it enforces that. But what actually explains the disappearance of the inheritance of wealth? Yeah. Am I?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's helpful. That's good. 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 Okay. So that is the question. Well, that's where we are. How does Durkheim explain the disappearance of these inequalities? Nick.
I had a question.
Yeah.
So those programs to get rid of inequalities.
Yeah. Yeah. Where does it come from? Well, we're already beginning to answer the question. So Durkheim says that for the forced division of labor to give rise to the spontaneous division of labor, you have to have this equality of power. And here he says that's equivalent to social justice. Okay, so where does the social justice come from? That's your question. Do you know what Durkheim says? Any idea where social justice comes from? Yes. You see, what is happening with all this is one other thing which we haven't talked about, and that's the change in the collective consciousness. Along with this, the collective consciousness is changing. So what is happening? What is happening to the collective consciousness as one moves from the abnormal to the normal? Yes, Alex.
It gets weaker.
Yes, well, that generally, as one moves to organic solidarity, it gets weaker. But what about its content, Armand? It becomes more focused on justice, social justice. We'll come to your question in a minute, Nick. Social justice becomes important. What else? Yes, Jessica? Cult of the individual, we begin to actually worship, in a sense, the individual. We begin to be more concerned about individual rights, human rights, the respect for the individual, the integrity of the individual, in the cult of the individual. And one other thing that he sometimes... Yes, Anders?
Cooperation.
Cooperation. The morality of cooperation. The idea that cooperation... is a moral rule that we should cooperate with one another. These are the three features of the collective consciousness that have to change and that do change as one moves from the abnormal to the normal division of labor. Yeah. Let's just, and we'll still come back to your question, Nick. It's a very deep question. But let me just read to you page 338. 338 begins to sort of asking these questions. And the last, why don't you read the last paragraph on 338? The last paragraph on page 338. But rules by themselves are not sufficient for organizing the division of labor and leading to solidarity.
They must also be just.
The rules must also be just. That is, the competition among people should be equal. Everybody should have the access to the same resources for competing with one another. Yes, there should be equalization of competition. Go on.
If, on the other hand, you call to mind that the collective consciousness is increasingly reduced to the cult of individual, we shall see that the characteristic of morality in organized societies, as compared to segmentary societies, is that it possesses something more human and consequently more rational about it.
So he's suggesting that the collective consciousness is now increasingly focused on the individual and on the individual's rights and human indignity. Go on.
It does not cause our activity to depend on ends that we are not directly concerned.
That is to say, no longer is some religion above us that we obey the rules, but we become implicated actually in the rules themselves.
It does not make us the servants of some ideal power.
There's a sense in which we are now more rationally controlling society. But Marx in here, go on.
If we are only to be charitable and just towards our fellowmen, to fulfill our task well, to work towards a state where everyone is called to fulfill the function he performs best.
Everyone is called to fulfill the function he performs best.
And we receive a just reward for.
And we'll receive a just reward for their effort. So that's the idea of the meritocracy, the reward. So there is the idea of social justice and the cult of the individual that must develop in order for the abnormal form to lead to the normal form. And then if we go and look on 339, 340. Yes. Yes. On the bottom of 339, 2, 4, 6, 7 lines from the bottom. Jason, why don't you read it out? 2, 4, 6, 7 lines from the bottom on 339.
On the other hand?
No, the new life.
The new life that all of a sudden has arisen has not been able to organize itself thoroughly. Above all, it has not been organized so as to satisfy the need for justice.
The need for justice. We've still got to figure out where it comes from. Yep.
That has been aroused even more passionately in our hearts. If this is so, the remedy for the ill is nevertheless not to seek to revive traditions and practices that no longer correspond to present-day social conditions, and that could only subsist in a life that would be artificial, one only of appearance.
That is to say, we shouldn't try and sort of bring ourselves back to a state where things were sort of in a state of mechanical solidarity. We have to move forward. Go on.
We need to put a stop to this enemy and to find ways of harmonious cooperation between those organs that so clash discordantly together. We need to introduce into their relationships a greater justice by diminishing those external inequalities that are the source of our ills.
Very good. So we need to introduce justice, huh? We need to introduce justice. Then go to the end of the page, 2, 4, 5, 6 lines from the bottom. Yes, it's the end of the book. Somebody should read it dramatically. Who's a dramatic reader here? Monica. In short, 2, 4, 6 lines from the bottom.
start our first meeting.
No, drama. Why don't you stand up and let's hear you? It's a big event.
You're sick.
But you had such a brilliant contribution earlier on. Sickness must be good for you. Durkheim wouldn't agree, but all right. Rachel, do you want to read for poor sick Monica?
I'll read for Monica.
Very good.
In short, our first duty at the present time is to fashion a morality for ourselves.
Fashion! We must fashion a morality of ourselves, right? This is social justice, cult of the individual, and morality of cooperation. All right, yes, fashion a morality for ourselves. I wonder who ourselves is, who he is referring to there. Yes, go on.
Such a task cannot be improvised to the silence of the study.
So what does that mean? That means what? Cannot be improvised in the silence of the study. Come on. Nick. Yeah, you can't do it by just writing a book as incomprehensible as this one. Right? I mean, you can't do it in the silence of the study, nor talking to yourself, okay? You've got to go outside and practice it. Very good, Rachel, yes.
It can arise only of its own volition, gradually and under the pressure of internal causes.
It can arise only of its own volition. It's going to happen of itself. Ah, yes. Gradually and under the pressure of
internal causes that render it necessary.
Ha ha, yeah, right, go on.
What reflection can and must do is to prescribe the goal that must be attained. That is what we have striven to accomplish.
So what are we striven to accomplish in this thick book? To prescribe the goal, which is? Sorry, yes, hands up. What's the goal? Come on. Well, not just increasing the division of labor, but Katie?
Well, repairing the division of labor, so it's the normal division of labor and the organic solidarity.
Marianne?
Solidarity!
Forever, right? Solidarity! Yeah, now prescribing the goal, solidarity, of course, it's going to be organic solidarity, as Katie said, very good. So, we can all, that's all that this book is about. We can prescribe, you know, the goal. How are we going to get there? We can't impose the goal. It's going to emerge of its own internal causes. Somehow, it's going to be a natural move from the abnormal to the normal. It's going to evolve somehow through internal causes. Huh? What are those internal causes? What is going to drive it forward? What do you think Durkheim's answer is? What do you think Durkheim's answer is? Yes, Jessica?
Division of labor?
Well, no, the division of labor is going to move from the abnormal to the normal. Well, what about the division of labor? What is going to move from the abnormal division and the fourth, the anomic, and particularly the fourth division of labor, to make it the spontaneous division of labor? Yes? Yeah. You see, I think there's only one answer that Durkheim. Very good, BB. I think, boy, what's your name?
Angelica.
Angelica and I disagree on this matter. I don't know if anybody else, but there's only one answer that Durkheim can give. And that is somehow the collective consciousness has a momentum of its own. And that somehow there's going to be, and this comes back to your question, there's going to be a natural development that we become, the collective going to become strongly imbued with social consciousness, the idea of the rights and dignity of individuals and the morale. It's somehow going to emerge. But where? From how? From whom? That's your question, Nick, right? That's the question. Yes, Aaron? Whoa! Page number! 315. Uh-huh. Where?
Yet at the same time, it is more strong.
Where?
7.
7.
9 from the bottom.
2. At the very moment. Yet at the same time. Is that where you are, Neil?
That's where Aaron was trying to get you.
Ah, yeah.
So he first talks about subversive tendencies, basically
people articulating their situation, their inequalities, apparently. And then he talks about here the work of holy human hand that can no longer so effectively oppose human man. The very moment when the flood tide grows more violent and dies, that can speed to breach, and that society basically freely evaluate their inequalities.
Yes.
But it's the necessity of the very society. It's an issue of space, of not responding.
Yes. 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 Very good. Excellent. Excellent. I think that is Durkheim is saying that the division of labor, in a sense, poses the problem. Somehow a division of labor for Durkheim is inherently going to produce solidarity. And therefore, he, like everybody else in society, will see that there are ways in which it doesn't actually produce solidarity, but produces conflict and disorganization. And that's the forced division of labor in particular. Because there's not enough social justice, because there is not enough equality of opportunity. I think he's saying that the division of labor, just by existence, by people participating in it, they will then make demands upon for equality of opportunity and quality of relations among the parts. Whew. Somehow the division of labor contains within it the impulsion to social justice and equality of opportunity. Josephine, you have a nice smile on your face. What does that smile mean? What would Karl Marx say? Go on.
He's turning his theory around.
Well, yeah, but what would he say? What would Karl Marx say, Neil?
It's impossible to get people, everyone in society, to think in some noble way that social justice is more important because it's going against capital's own self-interest. So, as he's talking about increasing the culture of the individual and thinking of, you know, personal rights and freedoms and all that, the capitalist class is going to think of their own rights and freedoms and what's in their best interest, and it'll never lead them towards wanting to increase social justice because it then comes out of their pocketbook to do so.
That's on the one side, on the one side. On the one side. But what about the working class?
And he would say that for them, being satisfied with kind of these temporary reforms and the coming together and unionizing and all those things to try to enhance equality will always still have antagonism between class and either have a revolution.
Yeah, he would say you have to have a revolution, but there is something very Marxian about this idea that somehow the division of labor will lead to the demand for equality. How does Marx see that? Does the division of labor lead to the demand for equality?
Put in a
Celia?
Yes.
Tell me?
Yes.
Yes, more? How does the division of labor lead to the demand for equality in Marx?
It'll lead to class struggle and eventual revolution by
Yes, so there's an idea, yes, that the division of labor, remember those pages in Communist Manifesto that I had you to read about 20 times? That, you know, there's the division of labor actually organizes workers so that they do make demands that seem to be similar to Durkheim's, for greater equality, for a socialist future. Yet, as Neil says, of course, the capitalist class will resist it, and it will only come about through class struggle, whereas this guy thinks it's going to happen evolutionary, that this consciousness is going to develop and there will be an evolutionary change from the abnormal to the normal. Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, Marx would say this guy's got his head in the clouds. It's almost as if, you know, this collective consciousness is almost back to Hegel. The collective consciousness, indeed impelled by the division of labor, will then lead from the abnormal to the normal. Yes, Marianne?
I think that what we're talking about is particularly evident when Durkheim talks about elimination of inherited wealth. It's like the inherited wealth that we
Yeah. What would you say? Do you think that there is a movement in societies towards this idea of social justice? Well, of course, you lived in a period, you, particularly this generation, have lived in a period where there's been increasing what? Increasing polarization, increasing wealth. But if you go back to Norway, you should all visit Norway. Yes, if you go to Norway, then, you know, you might argue, go to Sweden, you might argue that in those societies, there actually is perhaps some redistribution. Interesting. But even there, you know, in Sweden, they tried to introduce what was very famously called a Meidner plan, which would slowly but surely expropriate the wealth from the capitalists and redistribute it to the working class. That created a big struggle. And who won? A capitalist class won. They were not going to lose their wealth, their ownership of the means of production. But anyway, one could argue, if one looks empirically, it's an interesting empirical project, if anybody wants an interesting honest thesis, to see in different countries to what extent there has been constraints upon the inheritance of wealth through, for example, taxation. It might be interesting for you to just look at that in different countries. In some countries, actually, there has been an erosion of the control of wealth by the dominant class. Not so much in this one. Yes, Jane?
Does the
Well, I think it's almost it's like this. I think the division of labor, by its very existence, leads to the demand for social justice. So, even the abnormal division of labor, which is what Aaron was suggesting with his quotes, abnormal leads to social justice, leads to the normal division of labor. But somehow, that's the very existence of division of labor implies that not just the possibility, but the necessity of some sort of interdependence among the contributing parts. Where are you, Jane? There you are, yeah. It's very weird. It's very un-Marxian, perhaps, because Marx, of course, thinks this is, you know, your trouble is you become, you've read too much Marx last semester. I don't know who taught you last semester, but that person gave you too much Marx. I mean, you know, you think this is all hokey-pokey utopia. Well, yeah. But it is very different from Marx. Marx has a real theory of how you go from capitalism to communism. He may be wrong, but he had a real theory. And he was nearly right. Yeah, but here we just see expansion of this consciousness. Not clear what's going on here. Yes, Nick.
On that note, I mean, does Durkheim really believe this in natural evolution? Because, like, Marx, why else is he writing?
Well, yes, that's right. He does say, what does he say in the last sentence? What does he say? All that we can do is prescribe the goal. We've got to be sure. We now know division of labor is good. It's going to lead to solidarity and we should promote it, and sociologists should go out there on the barricades and pronounce the great virtues of organic solidarity. What do you think, Mike?
Me? Well, I actually think that he has a pretty significant role for sociology, because I think in the preface and introduction, he really thinks that sociology is the science of morality and is still the appropriate morality for the given stage of division of labor. That it can't legislate, it still needs to come about, it can set the goal, etc. But in a weird way, you can also see him as... Sorry.
It was waiting to come out. I could see it. It was bubbling inside. I could see it.
But
yeah.
Sociology itself is also a product of the division of labor. It's a new discipline at the time, a fresh specialization in science. And so you can see that actually the division of labor is producing the science and morality that will help solve the problem.
This is the Levian interpretation of the division of labor. No, it's a very interesting one. That basically, what Mike is saying is that actually sociologists have a major role to play in actually formulating this morality. And that is the function of sociology, is to actually provide the foundations of this new collective consciousness. Am I being fair to you? Yeah. You're not being fair to Durkheim, but I'm trying to be fair to you. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. It's an interesting question because you remember in the preface? This is what Mike is resting the whole case on. Very interesting. On this preface... Where are we? We're on page XX... that's 26, 26, preface to the first edition. There, let me quote Levium. Yet, because what we propose to study is above all reality, it does not follow that we should give up the idea of improving it. We would esteem our research not worth the labor of a single hour if its interests were merely speculative. You know, there is the idea that the sociologist has to be engaged in it. And I think what Durkheim is doing is saying, he is the medic, he is the doctor of society, he has diagnosed the problem. The problem is what? The abnormal division of labor. We've got to get rid of it. That's a disease. Got to get rid of it. How do you get rid of it? Well, he's suggesting we have to carve out a new morality. And sociologists, he doesn't put it so forcefully as Mike does, but I think that's one answer to the puzzle as to where, Nick, where the social justice is going to come from, cult of individual morality. Sociologists are going to be the practitioners, the agents of this new morality. Yeah. Anders, you don't like this, do you?
I like it.
You do? Yeah? Good, 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 good. Okay. Any other questions about this? Because I want to go next to Durkheim versus Marx, Lenin, and then we'll see the differences, Marx, Lenin, and Gramsci. Yes, Sasha. Absolutely. Well, it will concern and is concerned with the relations, regulate relations among organs, and also relations within organs, you might say. Relations within the family and the relationship of the family to the labor market.
So it is within.
So in that sense, yes, it's within. I think that's my view, and it would be relationships within the factory, the enterprise, relationship between labor and capital, but also making sure that, you know, there is sort of equal competition among enterprises. So introducing antitrust laws that regulates competition. So regulation of relations among enterprises and relations within enterprises. Yeah.
But it's not so much a regulation of like how things should function within the body itself.
Within the body
itself.
No, I think it's even, you know, basically there is labor law, of which is very important. I think, you know, labor law would actually encourage the formation, for example, of trade unions. We have a very backward labor law in this country. It makes it very difficult to form trade unions. It's one of the battles that Obama is going to be fighting in, hopefully, in the next few months, is to actually introduce labor law, changes in labor law that will allow workers to organize trade unions. That is, in a sense, the state is, in a sense, intervening, regulating within the enterprise, within the factory, equalizing the relationship between capital and labor by allowing labor to organize trade unions. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's very tricky because on the one hand, Durkheim says, oh, the state must be outside and mustn't intervene and change things. Change has got to come from within. Yet on the other hand, the state is definitely involved in regulating. It's a very two-sided argument. It's a bit contradictory what the role of the state is, because the state is never just external reflecting things. It also intervenes and changes things. It's a paradox. Look. This book is full of paradoxes. That's why we could spend the entire semester, Rachel, discussing it. Because it is so fun and interesting. Because it is so contradictory. And because you're so great sociologists, you'll find yourself trying to resolve this. We could collectively rewrite the division of labor. But we're not going to do that. We're going to move on to Foucault. Now, we're also going to see what is peculiar to Durkheim by comparing Durkheim with Marx, Lenin, and Gramsci now. If there's any more questions. All right. What's the story with Marx? Come on. What would Marx say? We've already begun this. The transition from the abnormal to the normal. He would say, okay, Durkheim, what the hell is going on here? Why do you think there's going to be a transition from the abnormal to the normal? As somebody already says, you know, elimination of inheritance of wealth. Marx says, that's ridiculous. Capitalists are not going to just keel over and give up their wealth. There would have to be what? Class struggle. Basically, what Marx would say is that, in fact, this transition from the abnormal to the normal, what would he say about that? What would he say about the abnormal division of labor? How would he characterize it? What would he think of the very label, abnormal division of labor? Ah, is that Courtney?
Yes.
Very good.
He would not agree with the label. He would say this is what normally happens.
Yes! What is abnormal to Durkheim, very good, is normal to Marx. This, you know, these crises are supposed to go away. They are endemic, inherent to capitalism. Class struggle, inherent to capitalism. The forced division of labor is inherent to capitalism. Capitalism will not function without the forced division of labor. Yeah. That's right. On the one side, and on the other side, insofar as there is increased equality of opportunity, what would Marx say? What would Marx say about increases in equality of opportunity, that people have better chances of moving up in the... Yes. Grace, sorry, yes. Very good, excellent, you got it. Basically, yes. He would say, well, it's concessions. Basically, it makes capitalism function that better because people, therefore, are less likely to forge into a collective solidarity, to build working class consciousness, build working class movement, if people are constituted as individuals. Okay, yes, very good. So, on the one hand, he would say, what you call abnormal, Durkheim, is actually normal. And insofar as you're going to make any of these changes, these reforms, you're just going to make capitalism a better place for a few people. And you're going to build consent to capitalism. Yes. 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 And what about the division of labor itself? What about the division of labor itself, Matthew?
I guess Marx would say that there are two dimensions.
Yes, there are two dimensions. What are they?
Forces and relations.
And what are they?
Who does what?
Very good. You remember something. Yeah, right. Who does what? Basically, there is the... what does Durkheim talk about?
Just the who does
what. The who does what? How the division of labor, as different people doing different things, is organized. The who does what with whom and how. And leaves out the...
Relation
of production, who gets what? The private property, private appropriation surplus. Basically, this book, for the most part, is really devoted to just specialization, but leaves out, from Marx's point of view, the relations of class, which are to do with relations of exploitation. Who gets what from whom? That is not in this, which is precisely why Marx would say eliminating the inheritance of wealth is just not going to happen, because there's a class relationship that don't get destroyed except through revolution. Yes, Anders?
But Durkheim might have a more realistic mission. He doesn't want everyone doing the same thing. Or he doesn't say that it doesn't matter what you do, you can get the same amount of money. I don't know if that came out fair.
No, it didn't.
Durkheim says there will be a hierarchy.
Yes, there will be a hierarchy.
Right.
Marx tries to get away with that. He would say, well, what would Marx think of this? This is the future, the utopia for Durkheim. What would Marx think of this? What is Marx's communism as compared with this? Hands up. Katie.
Well, for Marx, people are meant to do multiple things, not just one.
Yes, there's a fundamental difference of notion of human nature.
Yeah.
That for Durkheim, you realize your potential by specializing. For Marx, you ultimately realize your potential by doing different things. You are a multifaceted individual. Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. You remember this picture? Realm was not a picture. Realm of necessity. One of the few moments in my life where I don't have a picture. Realm of freedom. What was this? Remember? This was communism. So what would Durkheim think of this? Well, what Marx is saying, you know, this realm of freedom is where we truly realize our potentialities. What would Durkheim think of that, Felipe?
That you're born to do those things.
Yeah, you're born to do certain things. He wants something like this. So what would he think of this? How would he see this? Yes,
but
Mary.
Mari. Even for like the realm of freedom, like quote unquote, like it's irrelevant. Like we have a necessity, and that's our purpose. Like it's not personal. It's like you're finding your necessity, and that is like how you. That is your talent, but it's within a bigger picture. So it's not even like. Does that make sense at all? Like it's towards a greater goal. So like it is. It's always necessary.
What's always necessary? For whom?
Your job in society, your role in the...
Durkheim, you're talking about Durkheim. Ah, yes, Durkheim has the idea, you specialize and you have a sense of the whole.
Right.
Absolutely.
The idea of a realm of freedom is just obsolete.
No, it's something more, it's worse than obsolete. Yes, it's very different. You know, for Durkheim, the idea we're all specializing in a factory, or it's basically a performance, it's what is theatrical... performance, right? That's the communism. Whereas for Marx, it's every individual with his multiple talents doing different things, developing their multiple talents. What would Durkheim think of this realm of freedom, given that he's interested in this hierarchical common collective project, Marianne?
I think he would think that it was redundant, almost. Like, the realm of necessity is the realm of, like, that's how you realize yourself, and that's like, the realm of freedom is so that you have space in which to discover yourself and develop your
Yes, but what would he? How would he react to this idea? You know, Grace?
I think you'd say they're being unproductive. That the workers are being unproductive.
They are being unproductive. But he would also what? You know, what would Claudette? It wouldn't very good. It wouldn't result in interdependence and solidarity, but it would lead to, and no, what's your name?
Mina.
Mina, very good.
Well, when you say that we're limited by our aptitudes and our tastes.
Sorry?
We're limited by our aptitudes and tastes.
This is Durkheim, yeah? Yeah, that's right, but what would he think of this? He sees this in front of him, he sees a film of this, and what would he react? Courtney. No, it's not Courtney. Jeepers, that's wrong. Oh, you're Andy, right?
I guess I think he would see it as possibly creating a discontinuous division of labor.
Ah, discontinuous division of labor. Now we're getting interesting. Malcoordination, because no coordination here. Charita.
Yeah. On 334, he says, why should more dignity attached to being complete and mediocre than in leading a more specialized life, kind of life, but one more intense, particularly when you're capturing the stable yet lost?
Uh-huh.
He thinks that the realm of freedom, this whole, like, multifaceted thing is kind of, like...
You're definitely not a good idea, and it's discontinuous, it's not organ, it's not interdependence, but what would, it's even worse than that though, isn't it? It's even worse. He would be boiling, he would be frothing at the mouth, Theron.
You would call it either antisocial or pathological.
He would call it antisocial or pathological, yes, we're getting nearer, we're getting warm and hot, Sasha.
Is it mechanical
solidarity? Whoa. No! Why is that mechanical solidarity?
Well, I mean, I feel like it's...
Mechanical, no individuals at all. Here we got multifaceted individuals.
But it's not really...
But you're right. Why is it mechanical solidarity? Because there is no... division of labor. That's why you said that. But yes, just because there's no division of labor doesn't actually mean in this case that there's mechanical solidarity. There'll be no... I mean, there'll be what? It's a non-concept for Durkheim. It's anarchy. It's absolute, it's complete chaos and anarchy. If you wish the discontinuity, but it's not a division of labor at all. It's not even an abnormal form. It's worse than the abnormal form. It's complete chaos and anarchy. He would go blue in the face.
Anarchy.
Huh?
Anarchy's not chaos.
Oh, yes, it is. The power of the professor. P.P. Yeah. Anyway, you all get the same point, that he has no relation, he can't understand this. Freedom for Durkheim only comes with discipline by situating oneself in a hierarchy in the division of labor. So the question is this any better for Durkheim? The realm of necessity. Hands up, Katie. Yes.
There's no real division of labor there either. No one is specializing. Everybody's rotating.
Yeah, that's the.
Things are getting done, the necessary thing.
That's an interesting argument. There, in fact, insofar as there is rotation of labor, there isn't a division of labor. What's the? What is he? What does Marx call this? He calls this production by associated producers, right? Yeah. So some idea of collective organization. I don't know, this isn't, this. You may be right, Katie, that there is no division of labor here, but this is getting nearer to Durkheim. Actually, Durkheim actually thinks that the occupational groups and perhaps even self-regulating groups is important. So one might argue that this realm of necessity is nearer to the Durkheimian normal division of labor. You might think so. Yes, Jason.
But if it were the normal division of labor and people were situated where they were meant to be, you know, predestined for birth, then wouldn't what they're doing in society be part of the realm of freedom? Like, that's what's actually fulfilling for them.
Yes, this is the realm of freedom for Durkheim. Yes, that's right. Because they realize themselves in the division of labor, there's nothing really fundamentally outside the division of labor. As there is for Marx and Engels. Yes, so this, and the question is, well, Katie's right. I mean, insofar as there is rotation here, is there really that true division of labor? Is that the intensity of activity that can be produced solidarity? Is this what Durkheim is concerned with, the production of solidarity? Marx is probably concerned more with the organization, self-organization. But anyway, this is much closer to the normal division of labor. Much closer to the normal division of labor. Okay, very good. Now, what might Durkheim say back to Marx? You remember our criticism of Marx? That he said, you remember this picture? You won't remember it, Olivier, but let me show you. It's one of my more beautiful pictures. Competition. Remember this, competition leads to what? Crisis leads to class struggle. We won't go into the details. Leads to communism. That's Marx. And we said, no, you're wrong, Marx. It leads to organized capitalism. Now tell me, what might Durkheim say? What is this organized capitalism after all? Neil.
Durkheim would say that's his normal division.
Yeah, this might be seen to be closer to his normal division of labor because, of course, the state is in here organizing this organized capitalism. So there may be some claim that, in fact, this organized capitalism, social democracy, Norway, is, in fact, the future of capitalism and close to the normal division of labor. Yes, Durkheim might say to Marx, oh, Marx, you've got the theory wrong, you were nearly right, but in fact, communism doesn't emerge from competitive capitalism, but organized capitalism, which is none other than my normal division of labor. And by virtue of that, this is the normal division of labor. What then is the earlier one? What is this? Abnormal, brilliant, you're geniuses, great, abnormal. Well, at least you think like me. Just the same. Yes! The abnormal division of labor, because of course that's where crises come, that's where you have class struggle, and then that's all going to get smoothed out with. That's what Durkheim could say back to Marx. Yes. 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 Let's see if we can do this one. Lenin. Lenin, remember Lenin? This is the great picture of Lenin. Thousand threads, the moon. Then we get to the dictation, the proletariat, and then communism. Where is the normal division of labor here? Any ideas? What happens under the DFP? What happens under the DFP? Greg?
People are elected. They just, you know, it could be anybody that could be running these Soviets, and they combine together.
Okay, basically, officials are elected subject to instant recall given average work person's wage. The military is decentralized, subject to control of the people, and the parliament is turned from a talking shop into a working body. That is what we call radical democracy. He's a great radical democrat, Dirk. Oh, radical democracy. But what's the economic moment? What's the economic moment of the DFP? The economic moment of the DFP. What's the principle that defines the dictation of the proletariat? From each according to their
labor.
From each according to their labor. Well, no. From each according to their abilities. To each according to their labor. Work. Not communism. That's needs. But work. So that's the principle of what? From each according to their abilities. To each according to their work. That is, people are rewarded for their labor, which is what?
Meritocracy.
That is Durkheim. So in a sense, there is a Durkheimian moment to the dictation of the proletariat, the economic moment, the division of labor, the big state, the regulating state, the planned state, the division of labor. That is a sort of almost Durkheimian. And I think that Lenin would also be concerned to actually promote some equality of power between the different parts of society. But what is missing from Durkheim is what? Radical democracy. Yes, Aaron.
Well, he's also making force.
Force.
Well, Lenin's whole project is the legitimacy of violence.
Ah, you mean this over here? You need violence to overthrow this order. To get from here to here, you need a revolution.
And the continuation of violence under the GOP.
Oh no, that, you've just been listening to Mike Levien. That's not Lenin. No. Basically, force is only used against whom? Come on, Aaron.
Against capitalists.
Yeah, that's right. When the capitalists were away, the force fizzes away. Or it's the armed people. What did he say? Wink, wink. You mean you're caught in the middle in a contradictory position? Yeah. Okay, yes. But the most is radical democracy. Lenin's radical democracy is just not present in Durkheim's imagination of the future. All right, we got one more. We got 2 minutes. Gramsci. Now this is the big question. Gramsci, hegemony and solidarity. Yes, Neil.
I think Gramsci's probably the most similar in the way that his solution is. I think for Durkheim, it seems to be all about the collective consciousness, and that's how we're going to change things. And that's the most similar to Gramsci's idea of invading civil society with a war of position and changing ideology and hegemony.
Very good. What's the difference between hegemony and solidarity?
Is that it's one person's, well, it's one class's, you know, their interests being imposed on everyone else.
Right, so hegemony is the domination of one class over another. The combination of force and consent, the organization of the consent of the subordinate class to a dominant class. There is, in the idea of hegemony, domination. There may be interdependence, but there's domination. Whereas for Durkheim, solidarity involves reciprocal interdependence, and there's no sense of domination. But there is what? There may be no sense of domination, but there is what? Hierarchy. Very good. There is hierarchy. Ah, you know, this is the most tricky one. As Neil said, it's the closest.
It's in the sense that ideas are what will
Well, like something
yes.
Like a revolution is
yes, ideas are very important for Gramsci, the idea of ideology as the cement of society, just as the collective consciousness is, in fact, the underpinnings even of organic solidarity.
Gramsci thinks sociologists are useless.
Gramsci thinks that sociologists are useless. Oh, this is very important. That's brilliant. That's four B's. No one's ever got a four B's. Yes, Gramsci thinks that sociologists are useless. Now, what's the significance of that?
Because he thinks the state is essentially everything. So poli-sci guys will have the solutions, whether it be civil society, how the state intervenes, or whatever. Whereas Gramsci thinks,
right.
thinks that the state can actually play a regulatory role in all that.
Right, right. For Gramsci, the state is the center of the organization of domination. For Durkheim, civil society, the division of labor, the occupational groups are the center of solidarity. Durkheim, Gramsci explicitly thinks that Durkheim is in cuckoo land. He does not believe that you can get this spontaneous solidarity through the division of labor. It has to be organized. That is a brilliant quote. The quote on 238 or whenever, what is it? Two something or other. In the prison notebooks, where indeed he says that sociology deals with the trivial. Basically, he's arguing explicitly against Durkheim, who says that solidarity is going to emerge spontaneously. Consensus is going to emerge in division of labor. Gramsci says, no, it's going to be organized by state. Yes, you are released. And we will turn to Foucault on Thursday. Very good. Never thought of that. Very good.